Well, we'd have to have a war to stop it from happening, but it's all madness. The discourse is so mad. It's sorry to bring it up in some ways. It's time. It's 11 o'clock. Hang around for Illinois World at Labor Hour. It's an interview with Steve Early. It's going to be good, I'm sure. I think that covers most of the loose ends of the show, but I don't know. The poet's in the house.
We'll be right back. Hello, folks. Welcome again to the Illinois World at Labor Hour, the January 7th, 2012 edition here on WFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here during this hour program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who has some workers' interest news for us and later in the show. The Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's brand new poem for this week, is entitled Vampires Just Don't Care. Also with us today is Jason Kozlowski and Bob Polesny and co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorrell. Now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
On Wednesday, President Obama appointed three members to the National Labor Relations Board, bypassing fierce opposition from Republicans who claim the agency has leaned too far in favor of unions. The appointments came just hours after Obama used a similar move to install former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray to head the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Both moves infuriated GOP leaders who threatened a legal action and warned that Obama was setting a dangerous precedent by ignoring the will of Congress. Union leaders praised the decision, saying it was a legitimate response to Republican gridlock. Obama appointed Deputy Labor Secretary Sharon Block, union lawyer Richard Griffin, and NLRB counsel Terrence Flynn to fill the vacancies on the five-member board, giving it a full contention for the first time in more than a year. Block and Griffin are Democrats, while Flynn is a Republican. The board, which referees labor management disputes and oversees union elections, has been a prime target for Republicans and business groups since it filed a lawsuit last year that accused the Boeing Corporation of illegally retaliating against union members. Obama, in a prepared statement, said that the nation deserves to have qualified public servants fighting for them every day, whether it is to enforce new consumer protections or to uphold the rights of working Americans.
Harking back to the labor wars it instigated against the United Auto Workers in the 1990s, it looks like earth-moving equipment manufacturer Caterpillar is up to its old union-busting tricks, this time north of the border. In an effort to slice over half the pay from its unionized assembly workers, Caterpillar-owned subsidiary Progress Rail locked out about 500 members of the Canadian auto workers at its electromotive factory in London, Ontario, on the evening of January 1st, when negotiations broke down and CAW did not go on strike. CAW President Ken Lawenza said that Caterpillar is insisting upon wage cuts for locomotive assembly workers from roughly $35 an hour to $16.50 an hour, while also proposing that workers contribute 25% of their health care costs and threatening to eliminate pension benefits in a manner that would have made Carnegie Steel Company Chairman Henry Clay Frick proud from the 19th century, which his lockup precipitated the Homestead Struggle in 1892. The company built a wire fence around factory grounds on Wednesday, December 30th, a clear sign of the impending lockout. CAW members fear that Caterpillar-owned Progress Rail, if it does not get the concessions it demands, will move production to its recently opened assembly plant in Muncie, Indiana, whose workers make about $12 an hour and where turnover rates are high. Union members are also outraged that the company insists upon any concessions, particularly such steep ones, when Caterpillar is reaping record revenues and record profits of $2.7 billion in 2010. And in 2010, Caterpillar paid retired CEO Richard Owens $22.5 million, including $16 million in stock for just a half year's work.
Bob? Interesting, Jason, because also in Canada, in Quebec, Canada, 800 members of the United Steelworkers are locked out by Rio Tinto Alcan. The Anglo-Australian mining giant Rio Tinto has owned the company since 2007. Rio Tinto has assets valued at over $80 billion and recorded over $14 billion in profits in 2010. The principal issues at the Alma aluminum mill are wages, seniority, and an employer demand to eliminate contract language restricting the subcontracting of jobs. Contracting so-called non-core jobs is a blunt instrument to reduce labor costs and weaken the local union. Rio Tinto calculates that, like Vale Inco last year, it can outlast workers at just one of its global operations in a dispute that will only marginally affect its revenues. The United Steelworkers claim that helicopters are already bringing scabs into the mill to backstop the local managers. At Rio Tinto, the United Steelworkers is likely the most advanced of all trade unions in shaping global unionism and fighting across borders and continents. The USW's strong global connections to unions representing Rio's aluminum smelter workers in France and the United Kingdom and the company's mine workers in the U.S. and Australia, the global corporation will not be able to simply put Alma on ice until the workers give up. David?
Okay, this is from our West Coast correspondent, an occasional call-in guest on the Illinois Labor Hour, John Ryman in Oakland, California. This is a report from Oakland on the Occupy movement. There has been an orchestrated police crackdown on the remaining occupiers of Occupy Oakland. While there is no large-scale occupation in the park itself anymore, there has been an ongoing vigil on the surrounding sidewalk. This has included a small food table. There is an agreement with the cops to allow one small teepee and the food table as a symbol. The cops claim that the occupiers were overstepping the agreement upon limits. In any case, they have made raids on this occupation as well on a vacant house that has been occupied for a month now. In the case of the house, they simply arrested everybody rather than even giving them a chance to leave. Late Wednesday night, they raided the vigil and arrested nearly a dozen people. The cops came dressed in full riot gear. One person who was filming from 20 feet away was told to move back. As she complied, she was thrown to the ground and arrested. Another guy who has been one of the main leaders was arrested while he was standing across the street. The cops clearly were going after those they perceived as the leaders. The main case of this, though, is that of Marcel Johnson. He was arrested several days ago. They didn't even file charges against him for several days. And he was held in the county jail. While he was in jail, he was denied his psych medicines, and as a result, evidently got into some confrontation there. He is now being charged with a serious felony. If found guilty, it'll be the first of three strikes. In California, if a person is found guilty of three felonies, they automatically get a life sentence in prison without parole. And he's urging everyone to call the district attorney's office and express their concern over Marcel Johnson and call for the charges to be dropped. And you can call District Attorney Nancy O'Malley at 510-272-6222. That's District Attorney Nancy O'Malley at 510-272-6222. Tom?
After hitting a 30-year low in 2009, U.S. auto sales are poised for a second straight year of growth in 2012, the result of easier credit, lower interest rates, and pent-up demands for cars and trucks created by the recession. This sales forecast bodes well for the industry's continued recovery and for the broader American economy. Just 2 years ago, Detroit automakers were in bad shape. Car sales plunged as unemployment soared and loans became harder to get. Chrysler and General Motors filed for bankruptcy protection, while Ford avoided it only by borrowing billions of dollars. Now credit is more available, interest rates are low, and Americans need to replace old cars and trucks they kept during and after the downturn. Millions of drivers in their teens and 20s are expected to buy vehicles too, which will mean more jobs and overall growth. Car makers have announced plans to crank up factories and add thousands of jobs. Last January, Ford said it would hire 7,000 workers over the next 2 years. During the summer, GM said it would add 2,500 at the Detroit factory that makes the Chevrolet Volt electric car. Volkswagen hired 2,000 for a new plant in Tennessee, and Honda added 1,000 in Indiana. According to the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the industry should add 167,000 jobs by 2015, a 28% rise over current levels. Jason?
Now, this is Bill. I got a little comment about this story. I don't really like that story. I don't like hearing those numbers. I don't like those jobs being generated because I don't like the planet that I depend on to live to be further degraded by internal combustion engines. What I would rather see are those factories being used to build things that do not destroy this planet, and that those people be hired to build things like that. And that is one of the giant failures of the Obama administration, that he didn't have Van Johnson way out there, and I do have some critiques of Van Johnson, and a green industrial agenda, and really promote it and push it and have that. And I've said this before, I'm not even saying a go-to-the-moon level. We need a World War II level effort and do things like we did in World War II, where we could take these car factories and hire a whole bunch of people and start cranking out bomber planes. We need to do the same thing with other items. One thing would be real decent electric cars, and another thing would be all of these other things like solar panels, wind generators, and so on and so forth, things that we know how to make and can make and we should be making instead of cars powered by gasoline and diesel fuel.
Very good point, Bill. In fact, there's an excellent film that I think we've recommended before on the Illinois World Labor Hour. It's Who Killed the Electric Car? This is a really eye-opening film to show you exactly why there hasn't been any kind of development in electric car technology or mass production like you advocate, Bill. But the reason this is, and also the reason why we have all these, aggressive corporate wars throughout the Middle East to control the world oil supply is the oil company corporate special interest. I mean, they're one of the big three of the corporate special interests that control our government,
which collaborated with auto companies to drive out public transit in yep. Los Angeles and other cities in the immediate post-World War II period.
Yes, indeed. And, Who Killed the Electric Car? That's documented in that film, too, Jason. So, yes, indeed, Bill, I agree 100%.
And also, there's a scene. I'd always been kind of skeptical of the whole oil company influence on the cars. And I always wondered about the car company's motivation in keeping internal combustion engines. And there is one scene in that book where somebody goes through all of these items that you have to buy after you buy the car that wear out and go bad on an internal combustion engine that would not exist in a electric car. And I'll tell you right now, last spring, I had to spend, including the work that I did myself, I probably had to spend it close to $800 just fixing things on my car that would not exist in an electric car.
Yes, and also oil companies have large segments of auto company stock too, and that's been the case I think going back to the late 1940s or even before.
Right.
Tom?
Hey, according to the U.S. Labor Department, weekly applications for unemployment benefits dropped to a seasonally adjusted 372,000 last week. That is 11% lower than at the same time last year, so the job market is looking a little brighter at the start of this new year. Those weekly unemployment benefit applications have fallen to levels last seen more than 3 years ago. Holiday sales were solid, service companies grew a little faster in December, and many small businesses are saying they plan to add jobs over the next 3 months. The mix of private and government data released on Thursday showed an economy that is slowly strengthening optimism for job growth. The encouraging reports on the U.S. economy gave Wall Street a lift, offsetting renewed concerns over the European debt crisis. Jason?
Yes, just a quick comment on that. Harry Kelber just wrote an article this week about those jobs being added. They're almost every single one of them are low-paying jobs with little or no benefits.
Thousands of Utah construction workers are employed in dozens of large projects, not as traditional laborers, but as quote-unquote owners under a workforce misclassification process that critics say could allow employers to avoid paying benefits, payroll taxes, and workers' compensation insurance, according to an investigation by Utah KSL Television. On the website of an anti-union firm, UNI LLC, it says that if a business signs up for its services, that business's employees now become owners in the company. But these owners still work on the jobs that you assign and take instruction and direction from you, according to their website. The only difference is businesses no longer have to cover payroll taxes, workers' compensation, or unemployment. The website also says businesses that sign up will save that business 18 to 26% off its labor costs. The companies that specialize in such misclassification services are typically compensated by contractors who sign up for these services, which generally consist of advice and helping facilitate the change in employment classification or misclassifications for these respective workforces. Bob?
Yeah, a bill was introduced Wednesday in the Indiana legislature that would make it the first state in the industrial Midwest to outlaw compulsory union membership. And backers of the so-called right-to-work movement say it puts pressure on Michigan to do the same. In Michigan, State Representative Mike Shirky says the pressure will build even more if Indiana actually adopts a right-to-work law. Them making the decision to become a labor freedom state will, I think, shed the light on the fact that Michigan needs to continue to challenge our paradigms, and that's one that we need to change, he says. However, Governor Rick Snyder says a debate in Michigan on right to work would damage its sense of unity and efforts to rebuild its economy. Unions, on the other hand, say right to work laws encourage employers to create low-wage jobs. Zach Pohl, with the union-backed progressive group We the People, says there was a backlash in Ohio after Republicans pushed through a law to limit the collective bargaining rights of public employees. Ohio voters reversed that measure in the last election. And it's expected a right-to-work measure will be introduced in Michigan legislature as soon as this month. David?
Okay, Jason, you were just throwing out some statistics about right-to-work states before the show, if I remember right. You mentioned that all these states that have right-to-work laws have much... they lack in a lot of the economic indicators.
It's true. It was relating to Bill's point in the pre-show conversation about overlapping the map of right-to-work states politically, but also I would say economically, that you have most of the right-to-work states largely being in the South, but not only, because you have Idaho and Iowa and others, but there is a direct correlation in many of these states between not just being right-to-work states, but also having higher unemployment rates in the last few years, but also being among the poorest performing states when it comes to education levels, and also being among the poorest states. That is to say, those who are advocating, like here in Indiana, for right-to-work legislation ought to seriously rethink exactly what they're going to get when there is a clear correlation in various economic and education indicators between right-to-work status and drastic social inequality.
Indeed. Two bills aimed at establishing a legal framework for government and corporate censorship of the Internet are expected to be discussed in January when Congress returns from its winter break. The first is the so-called PIPA, or Protect IP Act, introduced in the U.S. Senate on May 12th by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. The second is the Stop Online Piracy Act, known as SOPA. This bill was introduced to the House of Representatives on October 26th by Republican Lamar Smith. The bills are the latest bipartisan attempt to give the government the ability to shut down the Internet or parts of the Internet. In the name of defending intellectual property and copyrights, PIPA would force U.S. Internet providers to block access to websites deemed as enablers of copyright infringement, particularly those outside the U.S. And PIPA also requires advertising networks and financial transaction providers to cut services to domains found to violate the law. PIPA adds a search engine, engines and others to the list of providers that can be forced to comply with court orders. If passed, SOPA will serve as what the Electronic Frontier Foundation has described as the U.S. government and private corporations' combined blacklist of sites. Provisions of SOPA include, one moment please, I think our caller might be calling in a little early here. Let's go ahead and take this.
SOPA's not good. Anyway, yeah, that's the gist of the story. SOPA bad.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Neil Parson from Not Another Sports Show. Hey, David.
Yes.
When you guys were talking about the Indiana right to work legislation, I don't know if you guys saw the story that with the Super Bowl taking place in Indianapolis, the NFL Players Association just put out a statement condemning the right to work bill and hoping that the right to work bill will be eliminated before the time that the Super Bowl comes, saying that right to work legislation, as they put it, is a political ploy designed to destroy basic workers' rights. It's not about jobs or rights, and it's the wrong priority for Indiana.
Well, that's excellent.
It's an amazing statement that they put out, and just wanted to make sure you guys heard about that, too, that there is a little bit of intersection that, you know, while we talk about billionaire and millionaire players, that they are actually caring about workers' rights. We saw that same thing in Wisconsin with the Green Bay Packers.
That's right. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for calling with that information. And, Neil, your show is on Saturdays at WRFU at 2 p.m. Is that correct?
That is correct. Or you can also get it at http://notanothersportsshow.podbean.com or subscribe to the iTunes.
Okay, and if they want to pick it up on the airwaves, what do they pick it up on the FM dial?
104.5.
Okay, Neil, thanks a lot for calling in.
All right, thanks.
Okay, goodbye. Okay, we thought that might be Steve Early, who's going to be calling in here at half past the hour, but looks like we got a few minutes. Tom?
Oh, that was my poem.
I had a brief story, if we have the time before getting to Tom's poem, that high school teachers and staff at Zion Benton here in Illinois are on strike and have been since Thursday over Board of Education demands and pay scales and health care premiums. That the Board of Education has made demands really from the beginning, since April, to double the amount of steps to their currency, to their salary structure. That would basically take them double the amount of time in order to get to the top of the pay scale, and they've been on strike against that and have received support from students as well, who have been picketing with them in the last couple of days.
Okay, very good. I think now we're going to go here to Tom Thomas's poem of the week, and hopefully we got some time to get some public service announcements in as well before Steve Early calls, but if not, we'll do it at the end of the show. So now here's Tom with his new poem of the week, Vampires Just Don't Care.
That time of year is here again, when vampires feed upon the poor, who can't afford to heat their homes because it's costing so much more. It is a time of misery, a time of failing human health, a time when many have no health because that many have no wealth. We are the 99% suffering from the rich one's greed. We are capitalism's slaves, and upon us the rich ones feed. No millionaire or billionaire will suffer from the bitter cold. No child born to poverty will feel the joy of growing old. The poor must struggle to survive because their jobs have gone away. Although there's plenty left to do, the rich ones just don't want to pay. One fact that is the worst of all is that the rich ones just don't care how many of the poor they kill, as long as there's a profit there. No millionaire or billionaire will suffer from the bitter cold, and few children born in poverty will know any joy in growing old. Vampires Just Don't Care was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 3rd, 2012, and was brought to you live today, January 7th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And, of course, today is the first Saturday of the month, so join AWARE at the corner of Main and Neal in downtown Champaign from 2 to 4 to protest the ongoing wars and occupation of Afghanistan, Iraq. And, yes, there still is an occupation in Iraq, regardless of the so-called phony withdrawal. But, anyway, they'll be joined by the Occupy Champaign Urbana, who are holding their weekly Saturday demonstration at the same time and place with AWARE's. So, anyway, that will be that. And also let you know tomorrow at 1:20 p.m. on Encore Drama, we'll present the film Mate One, the story of union organizing in the coal fields of West Virginia in 1920. These struggles preceded the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1929. The only time that people were actually aerial bombed in the United States, and that some people think that was by the U.S. government, but Bill Bugrell correctly pointed out that that was actually done by the coal companies.
Oh, actually, Dave, I also believe earlier that, wasn't it in Kansas City where there was a huge white riot?
Mm-hmm. Tulsa.
Or was that Tulsa? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Was there an aerial bombing involved in that?
Sure too? Was in 1921 in the Tulsa Race
About
riot.
The same time.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's right.
And then I know in southern Illinois, there was a gang of bootleggers, opposing gang of bootleggers, the Burger Gang and the Shelton Gang, in which I can't remember which side did which, but one of them did hire some World War One pilots to bomb the other, the gang's headquarters. So, yeah, it was interesting. All this happened in the 1920s. But anyway, you can check out Matewan on Encore Drama, and that's on Dish Channel 345, and you'll need to check your Comcast schedule for that. Also, don't forget to tune in to Labor's View TV on Comcast Channel 6 on Sunday, this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m., and this week's show will be up at the 2004 Republican Convention protests in New York City. And
is that Steve living up to his name?
Yes, I do.
Couldn't resist.
Okay, here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Steve Early.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Well, hey, thanks for calling in again to the Illinois World Labor Hour. And we thought, actually, our co-host Jason Kozlowski thought that this would be a good time to get you back on the air and stuff. I think it was about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago that you last called in. I know it's been a little while, but, man, there's been a lot that's happened since then. So I'll just let you kind of just start off with talk about whatever's on your mind.
Well, thanks again for having me on the show. It certainly was a busy year last year throughout the country, starting almost a year ago with the community labor uprising in Wisconsin against the attempt to roll back 50 years of collective bargaining progress in the public sector there. And later on in the year, we had several very important strikes, one against Verizon in the Northeast, second strike in September out in California against Kaiser Permanente involving several healthcare unions. And, of course, last fall, the Occupy Wall Street encampments all across the country, which became the basis for, I think, some very fertile joint work by union members and unorganized workers and activists in the occupation movement.
Yes, indeed. So, So what have you been doing lately?
Well, I spent much of the year doing some book touring. Back in March, my friends at Haymarket Books in Chicago were good enough to bring out a second labor-related book called The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, Birth of a New Workers' Movement or Death Throes of the Old. And so I spent much of the last 7 or 8 months kind of touring around, doing book-related events and discussions and forums and union halls and community centers and independent bookstores.
Okay,
talking about some of the labor-related issues, developments of the last year, and some of the reporting in the book.
Yeah, could you give us a little bit of a synopsis of your new book?
Yeah, it's an account, really, of a series of inter- and intra-union conflicts, very sad in many ways, very costly, very distracting, which occurred primarily between 2008-2010 within what most people think of as the progressive wing of the labor movement. These were a series of disputes about organizing and bargaining and membership rights involving the Service Employees International Union, the California Nurses, the Hotel Workers Union, the Puerto Rican Teachers, and within SEIU, the service employees, very bitter and ongoing dispute between
yes.
Some of its own healthcare industry members in California and the national union leadership.
Indeed, I think. In fact, we had some of those people. I think was it National Healthcare West was the breakoff union from SEIU.
Yeah, 3 years ago this January, tragically, the then president of SEIU, Andy Stern, imposed the second largest trusteeship in U.S. history on United Healthcare Workers West, which was a 150,000 member statewide healthcare workers affiliate of SEIU in California, the union's third largest. And this imposition of what you'd have to call kind of a labor equivalent of martial law triggered a rank and file rebellion. Thousands of workers signed petitions and cards seeking elections so they could leave SEIU and join a new union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, which now represents about 10,000 healthcare workers in California and a few newly organized ones in Michigan.
Now, this is really nothing new. I mean, the ILWU, the West Coast Longshoremen, they formed, breaking off from the ILA, the International Longshoremen's Association, back in the 1930s, because they felt that they weren't being represented and that there was actually a company union of sorts. But do you think this trend is accelerating here in recent years?
Well, I think as I point out in the book, the traditional strategy for resolving intra-union conflict or for addressing membership dissatisfaction with the policies of actions or union leaders has been to form an opposition group, a union reform movement,
like
a rank-and-file caucus, whether
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, at the local or regional, national union level, and mm-hmm. try to work within the system, work mm-hmm. within the structure of the union to change the leadership, change the policy, give members more of a voice. And that's really the strategy that was pursued in the 1970s within the Teamsters, the steelworkers, the mine workers, later on in the auto workers, you know, with varying degrees of success in those industrial unions.
Mm-hmm.
Within SEIU, people felt that the door had been slammed shut with this trusteeship, that mm-hmm. UHW, which prior to 3 years ago had been anchoring an emerging reform movement within SEIU, trying to democratize the union, give members more of a voice in bargaining and organizing decisions, was being shut down, was being mm-hmm. crushed. And so their plan B was to build an independent union, which, as you point out, was what people did in the 1930s under the banner of the CIO, when the old labor movement of that time, the American Federation of Labor, was not meeting people's needs and was not geared up to successfully organize industrial workers.
Yes. I've got some personal experience in this coming out of the Carpenters Union, a 32-year member, when back in the late 90s, after Doug McCarron became the international president, we formed a caucus, a national caucus. And, of course, it seems like it doesn't take too long to go from a national caucus to an outright opposition group and to at least talk of and discuss disaffiliation, decertification, and trying to form another union. But that process in the United States is very difficult, because in the Carpenters Union, every carpenter's local or group of locals within a certain region that attempted that lost in the courts. Courts backed the international union every single time. The only time it was successful was across the border in Canada and British Columbia. And the reason it was successful there was because of the difference in labor laws in Canada as opposed to the United States. In Canada, the courts and the laws give a lot of weight to the actual will of the rank and file. Where here in the United States, it's almost a feudalistic system. Just my experiences, to throw it out there on this topic.
No, very definitely. And that's pretty much what I report in the book about this conflict between the new upstart union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, and the service employees in California. At the time of the trusteeship, 3 years ago, the treasury, the local union offices of the dues money of 150,000 members was seized.
Mm-hmm.
Elected officers from statewide executive board positions down to the level of shop stewards were removed for disloyalty to the international union, and the national union moved in and installed appointed leaders who have not done a very good job bargaining contracts or representing the members. And of course, this internal conflict has pretty much paralyzed SEIU's West Coast healthcare organizing and it's healthcare organizing anywhere else in the country. So it's really been a major setback, not only for members of that union, but for the labor movement as a whole. Even though the emergence of a more democratic, more member-driven alternative in healthcare, the NUHW, I think is very inspiring and very promising.
Hi, Steve. This is Jason. You had recently written about a similar dissident movement that was successful in taking over the leadership in CWA in the Northeastern Local 1101. That is, even for another progressive union in CWA, to which you'd belong for about, 25 or 27 years, you've seen similar movements in different places. To what degree was that at 1101 connected to the Verizon strike or negotiations, or was it reflective of more deep-seated problems within the local?
Definitely a reflection of deep-seated problems within the local. This is 1101 is represents primarily Verizon technicians in Manhattan and Bronx and New York City, and the kind of ruling group in the local, the incumbent administration, had been in office for 30 to 40 years. There were serious problems involving mishandling of membership dues money, actual corruption that's still being investigated by the Labor Department and the Justice Department. But the rank-and-file opposition to the leadership had really developed over 3 or 4 years, well before last August's strike, and reflected dissatisfaction with the functioning of the local, the lack of new organizing, lack of resistance to Verizon's deunionization schemes, and the fact that the strike broke out right before the election where Reform Slate was running was helpful because the reformers were able to fill the void, play very important picket line leadership roles, and ended up winning 2-1 when the ballots were counted in November.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that with Verizon, which we covered that strike in when we had talked about that. I remember Dave had asked me whether or not I thought it would be a long strike, and I thought it would, largely because that's frequently the way that CWA would function. I was surprised, in fact, that it ended up being a couple weeks strike, and it's still really an ongoing issue with this not having been resolved, where Verizon is pushed for deep concessions, really what would amount to a set of two-tiered systems, and especially looking to roll back benefits. To what degree do you think that CWA ought to have conducted work to rule, or if they were going to continue to strike, that is, should they have followed on the momentum where there was such rank-and-file initiative and support for very innovative actions, including using technologies to organize roving pickets successfully against Verizon management? What should or what could CWA have done differently?
Well, I think certainly among participants, there's been quite a lively debate about whether the strike should have been maintained for a longer period of time. I mean, it was announced basically as an intermittent strike strategy, as an attempt to get the company back to the bargaining table rather than an open-ended work stoppage that would not be concluded until there was a tentative agreement. And as you just pointed out, there's not a new agreement. Negotiations just resumed in New York this week, and the company's concession demands are still on the table, and 45,000 IBW and CWA members are working under basically a contract extension, and at some point face the threat of the company declaring impasse and trying to impose concessionary contract terms. I think the decision to strike for 2 weeks and go back to work and try to mobilize on the job and put pressure on the company community was driven a little bit by the fact there's two unions involved. The IBW represents about 15,000 out of the 45,000 strikers. It does not have a strike fund. It was not geared up to help people financially, and the company was threatening to cut off their medical benefits as of the end of August. And, you know, so going back to work wasn't necessarily running up the white flag. The problem is when people go back to work, it's harder to maintain the level of militancy that was quite impressive on the picket lines from Massachusetts to Virginia. There's still 40 strikers who've been fired and have not been returned to work, which is another issue that needs to be resolved as part of any settlement. And you know, the continuing protest activity at Verizon Wireless stores, while it's been helpful and supportive of the union's bargaining position, may not be enough to move the company in a better direction in terms of the takeaways of pensions and health care benefits that it's still seeking.
It would have been interesting to see what would have happened had the strike continued, given that shortly thereafter Occupy Wall Street had picked up and gathered such quick steam. And as we talked about in last week's show, where we culminated how much had happened in 2011, that's obviously something that was huge, but just such a galvanizing force. You wrote a really great piece in Working in These Times recently in which you connected Occupy Wall Street to the upcoming 100th anniversary of the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and in talked about these circumstances and the difficulties that largely young and immigrant women had faced 100 years ago and the public reactions to both that strike and also to Occupy Wall Street. Tell the audience here what similarities and maybe some junctures you see between that strike, which will be 100 years ago, that started January 12th, and also Occupy Wall Street of today.
Well, just to go back for a moment to the Verizon situation that you mentioned, I think you're absolutely right, and it did inject some new blood into the Verizon contract campaign. Certainly the rank-and-file reformers in CWA Local 1101 related very well to the Occupy Wall Street activity in Zuccotti Park, which is right on their Verizon turf, and Verizon locals throughout New York State quickly adopted the much better kind of framing of the struggle, the 99% against the 1%, as opposed to some of the ways that the union had tried to position itself in the media in August. So that certainly, if the strike had been continuing, would have been a helpful boost to strike activity. I don't think it would have necessarily guaranteed a different outcome, and it remains to be seen what the outcome will be. But 100 years ago, this Thursday, January 12th, the biggest strike in the history of Massachusetts broke out in Lawrence, over 20,000 textile workers, and it was an amazing and quite unexpected upsurge, much like the Occupy movement, in this case led by immigrant workers, textile workers, who turned away from the American Federation of Labor and joined forces with the radical industrial workers of the world and struck for more than 2 months and successfully beat back wage cuts and created, one of the most inspiring strike models, really, in all of labor history.
Yes, Steve, it's interesting how the more things change, unfortunately, the more they stay the same. And your travel, where are you based out of, actually? Where do you live?
Well, I live outside of Boston in Austin, okay. Massachusetts, and during the 27 years that I worked as a full-time union rep and organizer for the communication workers, I worked in the Northeast and actually did a lot of work in the Merrimack Valley with CWA members who were employed for many years at a telephone equipment manufacturing plant in North Andover, which is right next to Lawrence.
Okay. Well, I noticed that the National Jobs with Justice campaign has been working very closely, doing a lot of support and solidarity work for Verizon, in particular out of Boston. In fact, the guy that's coordinated, Russ Davis, I believe his name is.
Yep.
Okay, you know Russ?
Yes,
out of Boston.
Jobs with Justice organizer.
And I know they jumped immediately into the Boston Occupy movement, and both supported the Occupy movement, and the Occupy movement reciprocated, of course, for the Verizon workers. And, the story of Verizon, Verizon wants the workers to have all these concessions and give backs, and yet they're extremely profitable, and the CEOs and upper management are just making money, tons of money, hand over fist. I mean, it's just such a perfect example of what's wrong right now in this country and the world, for that matter, in most places in the world. And they just seem to dovetail perfectly. Did you see? Did you happen to go down to Boston Occupy area at all?
I did. I caught the tail end of it. I was out on the West Coast for most of the summer, and as part of the little book tour I mentioned, coming back east in November, I had the chance to stop in and see Occupy activity in Santa Barbara and Denver and Detroit and Toronto and Troy, New York, or Albany, actually, and and then Boston, and visited Zuccotti Park. So. Got a taste of pretty amazing and very decentralized and unusual community and labor protest, which I think gives us all a lot to think about in terms of how to sustain a campaign against corporate power in this country that draws that resonates with the broader public in the way that some of the union challenges have unfortunately not.
Yes, well, that's excellent that you got to actually see, about a half a dozen or more different Occupy campaigns throughout the country and everything. Kind of what are your general impressions of just seeing, since you got to see, most people only experience maybe one, possibly two different Occupy movements. You've seen a half a dozen or more. So what are your feelings in general about the future of the Occupy movement? I mean, there's been some, criticism of it that it hasn't been a little bit more focused, if you will. What do you think?
Well, I think it's certainly a protest form that is kind of hard to sustain in an open-ended way, but the brilliance of the framing, the messaging, as the media consultants call it, the 1% versus the 99%, is so much better than anything unions have come up with.
That's true, yes.
And it really refocused the debate, this idea. I mean, the model seems to be transferable to a lot of other settings. Students have picked it up, mm-hmm. campus occupations. I mean, I think we're going to see more creative applications of it. I mean, my experience of it in these different places was pretty much a drive-by, just stopping by, talking mm-hmm. to people, seeing what was going on at various stages of their struggle. But I think, given where we were before this development, the fact that even during a strike like the Verizon strike, the company was able to go on the PR offensive and mm-hmm. Make an issue of how overpaid and greedy this particular group of telephone workers were, and actually were starting to get some traction with their mm-hmm. their media campaign to drive that message home. And a month later, they were on the defensive, the 1%, the Fortune 500, the people who run those big companies, and I think workers picked up on the fact that the Occupy movement kind of turned the table mm-hmm. ideologically, and that's what why so many people found it kind of inspiring in and around the union movement, which tends, as we know, to be less imaginative, more stodgy, less democratic, and more top down and not as bottom up.
And so much along class lines in doing that. The great irony of Verizon is going on the offensive, talking about greed, while the CEOs had made hundreds of millions of dollars and the top executives in the previous years, but also wasn't paying any taxes. And I think that's where OWS has come up so well. But also, I think reinfusing class and inequality in more direct terms of using the terminology of class and consciousness, but also terminology you frequently didn't see, like capitalism, treated as this baseline of what the norm is, and putting these terms in the fore again, and in a way, in a more class conscious way that many people, like you say, could gravitate to, including students who are moving into a period of time in which there are not just no guarantees of jobs, but where they're increasingly saddled with enormous amounts of debt in such a dire economy where there is so little promise for some guarantee of security, unlike previous generations.
I very much agree, and I think that the projection of a working class majority and the kind of unity between private and public sector workers, organized and unorganized workers, the working poor, working people who have middle incomes, or maybe what even have been sometimes labeled upper middle class incomes, I mean, people have come to realize that to a greater degree they're in the same boat, and that's very important to thwarting the strategy of Governor Walker in Wisconsin, which is divide and conquer. Get mm-hmm. private sector workers resentful of what public sector workers have, or in the case of the Verizon strike, get people in the Northeast who don't make $75,000 a year, which a telephone technician may be fortunate enough to do with the protection of an IBW or CWA contract, to have all of those people who make less unsympathetic to the mm-hmm. fight to maintain that standard of living and the decent benefit coverage that goes with that union pay in that industry.
Well, Steve, listen, I'm about out of time here, and I really want to thank you for calling in. Unless one of our co-hosts that haven't asked a question yet wants to ask you a question, why don't you give us some contact info for yourself?
People can get in touch via the website that was set up by Haymarket Books for my latest, The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. You can go to www.civilwarsandlabor.org and get some information on the book and any upcoming related book events.
And you have another book coming out in which you contributed a co-authored chapter on Wisconsin. We're coming up on the first anniversary of that. Could you pass along
that
information?
Yes, and I think that's one that people might be interested in. It's the first anniversary of the great events in Wisconsin last winter. This one is from Monthly Review Press. It's edited by Michael Yates. It's called The Wisconsin Revolt, The Building of a New Labor Movement. Good collection of pieces, and it's coming out in a couple of weeks, and people can check the Monthly Review Press website. I'd like to check that out and order a copy.
Okay, Steve. Well, thanks again for calling in, and good luck
with your having me on the show, guys.
Book tour, and we'll probably talk to you again sometime in the future.
Great.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Take care.
Bye.
We plant the food. really worth. It's an art that needs a scroll. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unhurt. And now when you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand up for your rights.